This is The Conversation. It's episode 120 with Brooklyn-based artist Ted Mineo. No relation to Sal Mineo, as far as I know. I didn't ask him, but I'm presuming, based on the fact that he's from Louisiana originally, that, they still could be. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for The Conversation podcast is theconversationpod.com. Go check it out. The most recent episode was with collector Steve Shane, and I recorded that both before and during the Miami Art Fairs, which Steve was at, and talked about some very interesting things, including not only his take on the Miami fairs and fairs in general, but also his interesting past. He's currently an anesthesiologist, but at one time, before he got into the anesthesiology / medicine game, he worked at the Anina Nose Gallery when Jean-Michel Basquiat was down in the basement making paintings. So, some interesting tidbits. Check that out. Now, back to Ted Mineo. Ted Mineo is a Brooklyn Bed-Stuy-based artist who burst onto the scene quite early via Deitch Projects. Yes, the gallery that Jeffrey Deitch ran in the 90s and 2000s until he moved on to MoCA. And there was a profile called The Debutante's Ball in the New York Times when Ted was just 25. We talk about that. We talk about Deitch Projects, and we talk about his more recent teaching career as well, among other things. So that's what you got coming up. I will talk to you more briefly on the back end. Thank you very much for being here, and I'll talk to you then. So you're, remind me, it's Bed-Stuy, right, in Brooklyn?
Yeah. In Bed-Stuy.
Got it. And how long have you been in that neighborhood?
I guess since around like 2007.
Okay.
Been about 8 years.
Yeah. So you're a relatively early gentrifier, would you say, or is that not quite fair?
I mean, I guess it's hard to say when you want to count the beginning of it. I mean, I feel like it's definitely accelerated. I'm sure. I mean, I guess it depends on what you call the gentrifier, but yeah, I'm definitely the white guy that moved into a black neighborhood.
I think that's a pretty blunt way of putting it. So
yeah,
and I guess sort of the flip side or the extension of that question is, have you noticed since you've been there, you know, how much it's changed?
Oh, it's changed a ton. I mean,
yeah.
It's just the faces getting off the subway have changed.
Mm-hmm.
The people moving in onto the block have changed. The
right.
The rents have changed.
Yeah.
The products in the deli has changed. The price of carrots has gone up.
You know, that's actually a comment that somebody else made to me. About their bodega, like the items in the bodega had gotten all fancy. That seems to be.
Oh yeah, yeah. When they start stocking kombucha,
right?
It's when it when it starts. That's when I got scared.
Yeah.
In the neighborhood.
Yeah.
I mean.
Right. So your story, if we're to sort of use one particular descriptor or a kind of overview angle, is one of sort of an early spotlight. I don't know if there are any kind of grand metaphors that apply, but basically I want to talk to you about the fact that you were a wunderkind of sorts and got discovered by Jeffrey Deitch when you were at Yale, right? And so let's talk about that story, basically. And I know that there's this piece that the New York Times piece, The Debutante at the Ball, is that it?
The Debutante's Ball, yeah.
The Debutante's Ball, right. But the reason I mention that is because I don't want to, I didn't read the whole thing, and I don't want to sort of use that as my template anyway. I want to use your story directly. So,
okay.
So I did catch the quote where you said that he walked into your studio and said, this work's going to make a lot of people angry, and kind of walked out shortly thereafter, and that you took that as a good sign.
Sure. Yeah.
So what was go ahead.
I want to hear your question.
Okay, I guess that wasn't a question. It was more a recitation of what I read. But so the question then is, what was the next step in your relationship?
Oh, with Jeffrey Deitch.
Right.
After that.
Right.
I didn't hear from him for months after that. It wasn't until I'd moved to New York and was living in a little roach infested apartment near the J train, right off Graham Avenue.
In Williamsburg.
With another school friend of mine, the artist Jason Tomei. And Jeffrey just emailed me and asked for a studio visit, and he came by with one of his the directors of his gallery, Suzanne Geis, and they offered to put me in a group show, which was a celebratory exhibition around the publication of a new novel by the author J.T. Leroy.
Right. Who, for people who don't know, would you like to do the short encapsulated version of that author, or should I?
I'd like to hear your version of it.
Okay. Well, I actually remember reading J.T. Leroy maybe a couple of times anyway in the New York Press, one of the weekly papers in New York. And
yeah, I remember the New York Press.
Yeah, and which is no longer exists, right?
Right.
And I kind of vaguely remember J.T. Leroy becoming sort of this, you know, capturing a lot of press attention and, you know, being fans with a lot of celebs and whatnot, or rather having a lot of celebs as fans. And, you know, and I don't remember if there were descriptions of J.T. Leroy being on the scene. But in any case, several years later, it broke that J.T. Leroy, who was only barely pictured, you know, in very small form, and it was actually just an avatar of some young dude, basically, and J.T. Leroy was supposed to be a man, turned out to be a woman, who mm-hmm. was basically just making this character up, and so all these celebrities who were supposedly friends with J.T. Leroy, apparently that was just a ruse.
Yeah, exactly. And J.T. Leroy was interestingly played by a person who's now who is working as an artist now, Savannah Knoop, who is showing around. Like, I remember meeting this person, thinking that it was J.T. Leroy at the time, and being like, "Hi, like, I read your book; it was really great." Like, and this sort of like awkward moment where. Where when I look back at it now, I'm like, what was this person like? Was thinking about like having to be that person, like kind of performing the role of fictional author and
right.
kind of figuring out what to say. I mean, I guess it's something that like, that's not probably that feeling isn't that dissimilar from any artist at a standing at their own opening or something being like, how can I, or at least that's the feeling I've always felt like I've never quite known how to sort of answer or present the physical person that goes along with whatever art I've made.
Right. Well, that's really poignant that you say that, because it seems that this romance with Jeffrey Deitch, for lack of a better word, I'll let you substitute your preferable word, but that your sort of relationship and then becoming a debutante with his gallery sort of thrust you into this role of, you know, artist as public persona, and it sounded like you figured that out pretty quickly, or you were natural.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, kind of not. Like, it was. It's hard to really say, because when I think about that that particular, so I feel like the biggest thing that happened to me was just being written about in the venue of the Times, probably.
Yeah.
Like, that sort of vastly eclipsed like the actual production and viewing and sales of artworks,
right.
You know, which was a really weird thing, because it because, you know, I was definitely producing a lot of like some artworks. I'm a kind of notoriously slow maker of things, but
because your works are very meticulous, right?
Yeah. Generally, they are. Like, not everything takes forever, but a lot of things take forever.
Right.
At the time, I felt like, okay, so maybe I should back up. So right now, what that article reminds me of more than anything are the kind of real estate, kind of like lifestyle features that you'll see a lot of times in the Sunday New York Times, where it's kind of this article that is really easy to hate, where you read about the struggle of some wealthy young NYU freshman who's
right.
Kind of like debating which neighborhood in Manhattan they should live in, you know?
Right.
And I mean, at least that's how I knew that I would have read that article if were it not about me. And even though it was about me, I kind of still read it that way.
So here's the question. So, was anybody courageous enough to maybe somebody close to you who to tell you how that article actually came off?
Oh, I had basically my best friend. I have one friend who was like furious when she read that article, and this is my closest friend and like my deepest kind of art buddy. Like,
right.
This is someone that I met like the first day of art school. It's who's a really amazing painter. Her name is Colleen Asper,
mm-hmm.
And she's kind of like my, like, if I have someone who I turn to for kind of like almost every like moral or artistic question, it's probably her.
Right.
She's like one of these vastly wise and brutally honest people.
Right.
And she was the person who was like totally like outraged at the article. She was like, you weren't wearing like I remember one thing that she was talking about where at one point the author of the article kind of describes the pants that I'm wearing, and she's like, you weren't wearing those, like you're wearing a different kind of pants. And so she was kind of like fact checking and being outraged at it, because like it came off with like the breezy details of it read sort of like a little bit like a celebrity profile, where
right.
You get the description of like you know, what someone's wearing as they walk into the restaurant. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like it's structured in that way.
One of the downsides to being 25, which is what the age you were when the article was written, and this happens even for people who are 35 in many cases, is that you don't know that when somebody asks you if they can write a profile about you for a paper, that there's a possibility that you're not going to come out, especially, you know, when it's a new talent on the scene kind of story, that you're not necessarily going to come out as true as
oh, sure.
you as
sure.
you want.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think like the thing that I learned pretty quickly was that the story is not me or my art at all,
right.
at least as far as that thing went.
Right.
Because the story is about students who are earning their MFAs and getting sort of just like moved through the system. And it's kind of like about that system and about the system of art fairs. And ultimately, it's about the, you know, the people who have power in that scenario. And,
yeah.
Which is, you know, the collectors and the, you know, the taste of, and Jeffrey Deitch's, you know, selection of like, okay, this is somebody that I'd like to work with.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the kind of extra bonus lessons that I took away from that.
Right.
But, I mean, you know, I don't want to totally I don't mean to only complain about it or something, because
sure.
That also just kind of like ended up connecting me with a lot of people that I would not have sort of met or known about otherwise.
Right.
So, I mean, that's, you know, that's my perpetual state of mind with New York City, really. Like, there's, you know, I love living here. There's so much to drives me nuts about it, but it's the connections with other people that
sure.
Make me love it. That's like kind of what it's worth for me.
Yeah, yeah.
It's worth it.
Well, so getting back to the story of the courtship with Jeffrey Deitch, mm-hmm. what why don't we, if you don't object, why don't we maybe get to the end before we get to the middle? Where did things wind up as far as the gallery and whatnot?
Well, things wound up for me for me with him, like the really around. It was around, I guess, 2008, when the extent of the, you know, the financial crisis was kind of finally becoming clear, and you know, I had been. I remember there were a few months where I was like, you know, kind of forever, like, probably in retrospect, horribly pestering the director that I worked most closely with at the gallery. And it was like, oh, what do you think's going to happen? Like, am I going to be able to sell any of these paintings? Like, can I get an advance on some of, you know, I was just like, mm-hmm. Kind of flailing. And eventually at some point, word came out that Jeffrey was going to leave to work at MoCA. And so he ended up closing the gallery down from its current, you know, from what was Deitch Projects.
What year was that, just to remind people of the timeline?
Oh, that was like 2008.
Wow. It's surprising that it was that long ago, actually, in a way.
Yeah, I guess maybe there was some interim between the time that he closed and then he went to MoCA. It doesn't seem like a long time ago at this point.
Right, exactly.
And now he's back he just reopened in the same space on Grand Street.
Wow.
That he had been in.
Are you in conversation?
I think it's just called like a Jeffrey Deitch. It's not Deitch Projects any longer. And he sort of like changed the his design.
Right.
That's his logo and things. He had used the Brillo box for a long time.
Right. And have you guys been in conversation?
No, I've been by the gallery to see a couple of the shows so far, but I don't know. I haven't bothered him. I haven't thought about like, okay, let me email Jeffrey, but
yeah.
I'm sure before long I'll run into him and talk to him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So basically you had a year and a half, 2 year kind of professional relationship where, you know, he put you in that group show and then what happened after that before he closed the gallery?
I had a show of my own there called Happy Sad.
Okay.
And within several different shows there and participated in all kinds of other weird things. Like one of the really great things about working with them was that there was, because it was the kind of space that attracted a wide variety of kind of artistic, you know, performers and object makers and spectacle producers, there was often like an extra little thing that needed to be done. Like they would, like for a few years, Jeffrey staged what they called an art parade that went around in Soho, where artists were given the opportunity to kind of like, you know, make costumes and things. And like, there was even like a budget for it sometimes. And
right.
So
right.
At one point, like, I got an email, or maybe it was a call or something, like asking me, like, do you want to make something for the art parade? And I was like, sure. I don't know what, like, I don't really know how to make costumes, but I got some ideas, like maybe I'll draw you a picture or something. And so I brought in like a little doodle, and then they found someone to make amazing costumes from my doodles, which was like, you know, which was shocking to me and
right.
and delightful and amazing. So I was, you know, like that, I was frequently, I felt really fortunate to be able to have that sort of thing happen. I was like, oh my God, like,
yeah,
what is this? You know?
So you had access to this sort of magically large production values and were part of a large production for the time that it lasted.
Yeah. Yeah.
And was the communication about the gallery ending and, you know, and therefore him stopping the stable or, you know, stopping working with the stable, was that clear and open?
They were pretty clear. It wasn't, I was all, again, fortunate in that, like, they didn't shutter in the night. It wasn't the sort of thing like a lot of galleries will just like leave town in the middle of the night with a lot of artists' work and right. things like this. So it was not a horror show. And they were like, you know, it's a very large organization that has like a lot of, you know, there's a lot of really great people working there who were, you know, in charge of returning work and making sure that everybody was kind of like, you know, squared away.
Right. Well, there weren't any golden parachutes to go along with getting your work back, were there?
You mean like a link to another gallery or something?
Well, I guess that would be one version, but I guess I was referring more specifically to like some kind of compensation package, which I know sounds absurd, but I have to ask.
No, we didn't get a gold watch, or I wasn't able to cash in my shares or anything.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure if anything, like I, you know, the, yeah, there may have been, I mean, I think there are people who have steadily been, either, you know, full-time or part-time employed, just maintaining his archives and his spaces and kind of like working on the production of, there was like a large, monograph that came out. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess you wouldn't call it a monograph, but a large book about the gallery that was produced a couple of years back. And so there were, I mean, those people had a parachute, and that it meant that they were able to keep, you know, stay employed and things. And a lot of them went on to work at other galleries.
Sure. I guess the metaphor that, or the image rather, that comes to mind is, I kind of wonder when the relationship ended, the gallery closed, you know, and mm-hmm. but you weren't alone because all these other artists were in the same boat. But I kind of wonder if it was anything like, you know, when after an opening, you know, after all the build up to a show, you know, and everybody goes home and you're left alone with yourself. It's, you know, if it had that kind of vibe to it, or what, how would you describe it?
I mean, I think like, ever since the whole time I worked with them, and like all the way up till now, like I was always pretty much like right at some, like just below boiling level panic. That's just kind of like my
wow.
general way of being.
Yeah.
You know? And so, that was consistent. I think there were, things that came out, and there was probably some kind of like changes that I needed to make in terms of like understanding like how, like what was like realistic for me to, what was a realistic way for me to be operating in the world. Cause you know, for it felt like a few years there, I was able to get by pretty fine just by making drawings, you know,
yeah.
which sometimes now when I think about it, it seems silly. But it was, you know, and so there were a few years where I found where I was kind of like trolling Craigslist to find any sort of job, and would get myself into very short bursts of employment and very weird jobs. And,
right.
You know, or it would be assisting other artists, which is something I've done as long as I've lived in New York, but I just did it a little bit more, which is always like a really fun way to work, because I, you know, you learn stuff.
Who have you worked for?
Let's see. I've worked for the artist Justin Lieberman, who's a close friend. The artist Meredith James. Let's see. I mean, those are the people that I've probably worked the most for.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've had a lot of other kind of jobs that are producing objects as part of the work, but that aren't directly in the art world. Like one of my first jobs was as a worker in a little workshop that made prototypes for toys.
Mm. That
so
can
we
be
would,
a
like,
good
little
living,
action
right?
figures.
That can be a good freelance gig, can it?
I mean, I'm not sure how much it would be good anymore without, because not the way that we were doing it, because we were producing, you know, clay originals by hand and then making wax versions and then making, kind of a plastic version. And then, but now most of that process could be done like so much more quickly with 3D printing.
Sure.
And so it was kind of like an introduction to a lot of like a lot of sculptural techniques that I'm so grateful for having been exposed to.
Like, right.
I'd never really made a mold before.
Right.
And because I was, you know, the kind of like a, you know, painting, drawing kind of artist, and not like a not the sculpting,
sure,
kind of artist.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to your ending the gallery relationship ending, and then you going on to, you know, going from making a living from your drawings to making a living like most people do, which is most artists do, from various cobbled together freelance jobs. I would presume that your that sort of steady level of panic that you described served you well once the gallery situation ended, because, you know, it's not like your system wasn't ready for being panicked. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I guess so. That's true. In that way, it was fine. I was kind of, you know, every now and then it was unpleasant, but I was, for the most part, I was like, okay, I feel sort of the same way that I felt before. There are just different resources available to me.
Yeah.
I think I came through it, you know, it was not a huge damage. So
right.
I think if anything, it was kind of like, all right, I was involved with that weird thing, which was great and strange.
Right. Do you think that because you were presumably one of the younger artists in the stable and also, you know, probably the one of the shorter relationships, that, you know, that maybe the other artists, I guess, already had other galleries that they were showing with? And maybe sort of as a secondary question, if some of those artists who had been around for a longer time with that gallery are some of the same ones that are actually coming back to the one that just reopened?
See, I'm not sure. I don't actually know who all, like, how he's organizing the gallery at this point.
Right.
I just, what I've done so far is see a couple shows and checked out the website, which was designed by Ben Jones, who's an artist who I know that Jeffrey was working with earlier. But yeah, I'm not sure if, I mean, I think it's kind of like, it might be about just the way that I operate in the world or something. Like, it's like the fact of me working with the gallery at that point so quickly out of school was entirely a result of the kind attention of others, and which I was grateful for. But I just did not have that that kind of forward entrepreneurial spirit, I guess,
right,
or something that directly sought it out. And so it might be, I think a lot of the other artists were working with other galleries at the time.
You know, I think you just described for me maybe the crucial angle of your story, which is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were kind of blown, if you will, or sort of momentum flung you into this career track that wasn't necessarily your personality type. That is to say, you know, use the word entrepreneurial, but like maybe more, a better way to put it even is, you know, a real extroverted go-getter climber type of artist who, you know, is really out and about and knows how to network.
I don't know. I mean, it's difficult for me to be able to diagnose those sorts of aspects of my personality, because I think I'm friendly, but like I have trouble caring about art career things. And I have trouble thinking about money without kind of sweating a little bit.
Right.
I try to, you know, but of course I, you know, you must, but it's, but I think it's yeah, probably this has something to, I'm just like not inherently, I'm the kind of artist, I think, that has trouble sometimes seeing the forest for the trees, you know? I think I probably have trouble seeing the trees for the leaves sometimes. Like, it's just something that happens with everything. You know, it happens with the objects that I make, you know, things like this. It's like I'm the sort of person who gets kind of lost in the little details.
Right.
And so, you know, it's less, not that strategic.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that, actually. You know, I mean, in this dichotomy, you know, you're the good guy for me. You know, I like, as naive and, you know, and whatever other sort of negative leaning word that one might use towards people who aren't savvy, you know, in a certain way, I appreciate the holding on to that model of artist, you know, because, you know, it's just an unfortunate, I think, byproduct of the way the art world has evolved, that it rewards, you know, personalities, you know, strong extroverted personalities and charismatic personalities in favor sometimes of work, or, you know, that's what makes the difference between an artist, two equal artists, is one that is, you know, that extroverted go-getter type versus the one that is what many of us, I think, just, you know, like certain people have visions that they grew up with of God being, you know, this dude with the white beard, you know, that we think this, that we sort of have this built-in sense of an artist as being, you know, a little bit out of sorts, you know, slash distractible, and and not, you know, you're sort of the sort of Jeff Koons sort of proto business artist model, which some people will say, yeah, that's the new norm, that's what artists are now. But I challenge that notion.
I think that's what a lot of humans are just being, or at least humans who are like kind of internet denizens, like are being, that's kind of what you have to be, that's what people are trained to be now, or just people who are aware of like marketing and branding and stuff as
right
ideas, like that's just, and so there's this like, you know, production of an identity and of a self. And, you know, I'm sure that I do that both consciously and unconsciously. And so, yeah, I don't occupy, a Jeff Koons kind of, attitude at all. It's like, it's hard to compare, like, but yeah, I present as probably a sort of squirrely basement dweller type artist more than other types. Yeah.
Basement dweller. Well, to refer back to our mutual connection, Zach Smith, mm-hmm. you know, who also went to Yale graduate school. Obviously I presume you were really young. You were the youngest person, it sounds like, in the program at the time, but when
yeah,
in talk,
I was like 20 when I started.
Wow, you're 20.
When I started, yeah.
Wow. So had you even finished like an undergraduate education? Or
oh yeah.
Uh huh.
Yeah, I came straight out of my undergraduate.
Right,
school.
Right. But I mean, it's, most people, I think, when they at the earliest when they finish their senior year are 21. Usually, that's my understanding. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was just gonna say that, given that sensibility that you described of yourself, being in what Zach described as this very vicious, I don't know, I don't want to oversell it, but, you know, a fairly intense and judgmental kind of environment, was that mm-hmm. something that you were able to sort of sneak through the, you know, or sort of make your way through those obstacles somehow and come out clean?
I think I probably came out less kind of less deconstructed than most artists, like mm-hmm. I think this is due in fact to me being very stubborn when I was there and kind of like sticking to my like stupidly slow reduction schedule. And when I think back on it now, because I teach at art schools now, I'm sort of like, I feel so sad for my teacher concerts when I think about like how frustrated they must have felt to like come into my studio and see like the progress that I had made, being like, okay, you painted like 2 more inches of that thing. Like,
right.
Like, what are we supposed to talk about for the studio visit?
Right.
And so during that time, like, surely my time there was largely really positive because I was fortunate to be there with a group of other artists who I really respected and loved. Like, I know there's stories about many classes where there are, you know, huge internal conflicts and kind of like, you know, battles among different groups of students. And like, there was like some small degree of that, but I felt like it was an overwhelmingly kind of like warm, fuzzy experience, at least for me and my circle of friends,
right,
that I had when I was there.
Yeah, that sounds invaluable.
And my class was one of the first that had started when Peter Halley I was there during his first year as the director of graduate studies. And so he was starting to slowly implement some changes in the program and hire different people. And so it was very much like a program in flux when I arrived.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. So getting back to your post-gallery or post-first gallery scenario, you know, you're doing the molding or the, you know, the toy making work and whatnot. And when and how does sort of your next phase of art world activity happen?
Well, I feel like the art world activity has like as far as a phase, like I would not know how to characterize it between then and now, because it's still I'm still intermittently in shows and things, and maybe things will happen where like someone's like, oh well, let's do a show with you a year from now, and then like six months from that point, like they'll be like, oh, the gallery's gonna close or something like that. So there's
right.
There's many things like this that happen all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the showing that I've done has been mostly in kind of like group exhibitions, and so as a result, like there's, I feel like my role within, like, I don't know, some kind of like, you know, contemporary art world, or I mean the world of like the stores that are art galleries, has been kind of like foamier and more diffuse than it had been before that time. And so my, you know, and as a result, like the, you know, the things that I make are not like geared to be presented always like in one big room all at the same time. And so it's more like I'm frequently moving from like small project to other weird project. And so things like the, as an artist, production has gotten weird, like sort of less centered, you know,
mm-hmm.
to be the sort of person who makes like one thing, then another thing that follows directly on the heels of that thing. And now there's kind of like many different overlapping threads of activity.
Right, right. And meanwhile, you're teaching, as you said, and is that all out of town?
It's about half out of town right now.
There's, okay.
I teach a few classes at in Philadelphia, and then a few classes at Brooklyn College.
Right.
Too.
Okay.
And there were about 5 years where I was teaching in Boston, which was a kind of lengthy commute.
Yeah. And there are other people teaching in Boston who live in New York.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's a whole community of us.
Right.
And that was, you know, something that I was really happy to be a part of in the last year was Dusko Petrovic's project, Adjunct Commuter Weekly.
Right.
His weekly newspaper for people who are just in just my situation.
Right. And what was your piece, or is it translatable here?
My piece was, it consisted of some photographs and a text that I wrote kind of about my, the things that were in my bag, as I walked through, South Station, bus terminal.
Got it. Well, we'll link
some
to
yogurt.
Got it. We'll link to that article so we don't have to just describe what you said in it. So it sounds like if you are had already taught at up in Boston for 5 years and that's already over and you're still quite young, that when you first started teaching, you were quite young. You must have, in some cases, not been that much older than some of your students.
I was younger than some of my students.
Is that right?
Actually.
What was that like?
What was that like?
Yeah.
That was something, that was a really interesting experience. And like, I think I learned a little bit about kind of how I work best with other people mm-hmm. from it, because so I had, I had friends who had been teaching for some years before I started. And so I would go to them in a panic before my first classes, and I'd be like, how are you supposed to do this? Like, how do you behave? How are you supposed to be in this, in the world as a teacher? Cause I didn't, I was looking for like the perfect sweater or something to like really let me stand apart from these other people.
Right.
Who are the students. But, and so I think at first I attempted to like present some kind of like more organized or slightly more authoritarian version of myself. But I quickly realized that the great thing about teaching is that it works when you are, most yourself. At least this is the great thing about teaching art, at least for when you're teaching something like a bunch of senior painting students who are working on their thesis projects. Like, and for me, it was kind of like arriving and behaving in a somewhat clownish manner and just performing my subjectivity as a kind of clown for them. That was way more effective than being a disciplinarian or an authoritarian figure.
Huh.
In there. And so, it was really easy to connect with people, because as long as you treat the artists in art school, treat them like they're artists and talk to them as you would any other artist, most people will notice that, and will, and you'll immediately be able to have real conversations with them. And just the hard part is getting there, really, for me. And that being interested has never been a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And and that's the most important thing, is just caring.
Right. But meanwhile, you mentioned this image of you doing the clown routine as opposed to being the authoritarian. And I'm having kind of mm-hmm. a hard time imagining you being, what is your clownish? Is that sort of hyperbole? Do you really just mean that you're being kind of loose and jokey as opposed to sort of firm and intense, or how does that work with you?
It was never like a rubber red nose. Like, I'm not a good juggler.
Right.
And so, I think it was probably a certain kind of looseness.
Yeah.
And figuring out like the ways that I could be honest while in the role of, in a teacherly role.
Right.
And I think that's always the, if there's ever like a certain kind of regret that I come away with, like after, a studio visit, it's always like, it's about that, about honesty and trying to find a way did I really express the nuance of the little nuanced problem that I have with the way that this work appears in the world or something like this. The struggle is to, I feel like as a sort of silly person, that was just the proper medium for me to, that's kind of how ideas kind of flow best from me, is through encased in a oily mass of silliness.
An oily mess of silliness. It sounds a little bit like some of the work you've been making, basically, right?
Kind of.
But what I really want to hone in on is this Because this is a really interesting point, and you alluded to it, but I don't think you haven't yet described how it works, and I'd be very curious to know if you have some insights in this regard. And that is whether it's a studio visit that you're doing now as a teacher, or a studio visit you're doing with a peer, you know, or for that matter, if you think you could imagine speaking to some kind of curator, gallerist type professional, how maybe the best way that they should do it, because I'm not sure that their level is always up to the snuff that it could be, is how do you address those kinds of conundrums in which you want to be critical, you know, when you need to be, but you don't want to shut the person down, you know, and traumatize them.
Well, I feel like it's somewhat different in like the, when you're in a pedagogical situation, because,
sure.
That person is paying you money to,
right.
to come in and work with them and kind of help develop their practice. Like it's sort of I feel like it's slightly different from meeting with a peer.
Sure.
But as far as like being critical, I don't know. It's hard to say because I don't know. I think it kind of like just depends on how things come out of you. I'm struggling to think of like a particular situation where, I'm just not the sort of person who is, you know, I'm not like a shredder of people's art right away, you know,
right.
Usually like I'm the sort of person who kind of realizes what I think slowly. And so a lot of times a studio visit will just be about kind of like just trying to like unpack what it is I'm looking at and maybe sometimes like what that person's intention was. Like,
sure.
I'm not even sure how important that is always. But I mean, you know, I always want to know what people have to say. It's kind of like,
yeah,
if you're in order to be a good, viewer of art, like it helps to care, you know? And
yeah.
Like, I think that's like, I get way more out of art now, ever since I learned how to care and how to love it, you know?
Sure.
I think like, if you don't give anything to it, like you shouldn't expect anything back or you'll only maybe, be delighted by, kitsch or trash, you know? Things that are kind of like contain what you're supposed to think in them, which isn't really, you know, that's generally not that interesting to me.
This woman, sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to point out that this woman, another New York artist that I had a podcast with recently, I think she put it well in terms of when you give feedback is when you have an opening for it, which is to say when you're doing a studio visit and that the artist is sort of maybe saying they're unsure about what they're doing or they maybe put these questions out that are either obvious or maybe more subtle. But those are the kinds of scenarios in which it's okay for you to say what you think about the work, whereas when somebody is much more confident, maybe too confident, overly confident, those are the times where maybe you do what you already described, which is you ask questions, you try to understand where they're coming from and so on, but you don't you don't give criticism.
Yeah, I mean, it's like sometimes you need a critic and other times you just need somebody to help you figure out what color needs to go there. Like it's like the problems are, you know, making stuff. There's so many ways for it's a tricky situation. It's hard to know how to proceed. Some people kind of have their some sort of internal compass and seem to know exactly what they need. And others of us kind of like, need something to push back against, you know, and sometimes that critical, you know, some strong negative criticism can be a gift in that it gives you something to fight back against. And
right.
Like some kind of boundary in a world that has like, so like that just kind of like permits everything, which is, you know, kind of awful.
Do you feel like you have your own internal compass that you know exactly what you need to be doing?
No, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I don't. And so, you know, I feel like it's frequently just very improvisatory struggle to figure out exactly what the best thing to work on is, or what the next kind of mission is. And so there, you know, I find it's become much, I kind of prefer recently working with other people more and working more collaboratively, because having other kind of like strong voices to push against just yields more interesting results, because it's like my, like if I'm making work that is about the expression of myself, or like, you know, if it ends up being about like me or my lifestyle or something like that, like I feel like that is probably going to be a failure. Like that's not really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's about like what I want to do is try to poke into something bigger and weirder than me.
Well said. I think that unless you have any objections, I think that might be a great place to wind down.
No objections at all.
Well, okay. Ted, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And We're out. Thank you very much again to Ted Mineo. That was great, wasn't it? And Ted has been a mensch. I have to say that there have been a few mensches recently and a few coming up who have been guests on this show, which I'm very grateful for, menschy guests. Thank you again to Ted, and thank you for listening to this podcast. I would very much appreciate it if you tell your friends about the show, if you subscribe to the show, ideally on iTunes, which there's a link to that option on the website. Subscribe on iTunes, leave a nice review on the iTunes page. It's really, I know it's kind of a monopoly, but it's the best way for more people to find the show. And of course, there's social media. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And donations to this show are a lifeline. They're very much appreciated. Even a modest amount is very much appreciated. I love getting those emails saying you have received a donation. Believe me, there is very little better for a small podcast enterprise than getting one of those emails. So your contributions would be very much appreciated. Thank you so much again for listening. Let us know what you think of the show via the website or social media. And that's about it. I will talk to you next week. Have a good one.